Thank you all for coming. I know there's you had your choice in a lot of symposia, so thanks for flying with us. There may have been many of you who were at the symposium yesterday, the oral session, which was excellent, I thought. And so some of what I'm going to cover is going to be a little bit redundant, but I figured it's good to start fresh, too, with people who may not, who may be coming new to this topic also. So what I'm going to do is talk about some of the background, why we care about gonococcal resistance, and what are some of the recent trends that have us concerned. And then our speakers following this, I think, are going to be excellent and talk about some of the laboratory methods and some of the programmatic implications for what we're seeing. So as many of you know, gonorrhea is caused by the gram-negative organism, Neisseria gonorrhoeae, and it's very common. It's estimated that 95 million cases occur worldwide, and over 300,000 cases were reported in the U.S. last year, and we estimate probably twice that actually do occur, with an estimated annual cost of $77 million per year. And the reason we care about gonorrhea really is some of the reproductive complications, such as pelvic inflammatory disease, ectopic pregnancy, infertility. There are places in the world, resource-limited settings, where neonatal ophthalmia and blindness is still a problem. And also, particularly for men who have sex with men, gonorrhea is a concern because of the heightened risk of HIV transmission when one or both of the partners is co-infected. The other important thing which we'll focus on today is that Neisseria gonorrhea has demonstrated remarkable ability to develop antimicrobial resistance, either through stepwise chromosomal mutations or the acquisition of plasmids for resistance. And the reason we care about antimicrobial resistance is because it can undermine treatment success, it heightens the risk of complications, and also may facilitate transmission by lengthening the time of infectivity. And so, as many of you who were at the talks yesterday saw a timeline, since antimicrobials were introduced for the treatment of gonorrhea, really in the 1930s with the introduction of sulfonamides, we've seen the organism develop resistance to each of the antimicrobials that have been used for therapy, beginning rapidly with the sulfonamides. And then we had several decades in which we were able to use penicillin, but chromosomal resistance developed during the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and then the organism became fully resistant to penicillin through plasmids in the 70s and 80s, and into most recently the fluoroquinolones. So this is a list of the antimicrobials that have been used for therapy over the past decade. And with the exception of spectinomycin, which is no longer available in the U.S., we've lost nearly all of these agents because of the development of antimicrobial resistance. And we're really left with a third-generation cephalosporins. And in the 2010 treatment guidelines that CDC issued, the recommendation is to use ceftriaxone at a 250-milligram dose. And if that's not an option, then cefixime. But also with the addition of a second antimicrobial, azithromycin or doxycycline, with the increasing recognition of the concern for emerging resistance. And so since 2007, when we lost the fluoroquinolones, we've been left with the cephalosporins as really the foundation of treatment. But this is, you are probably familiar, an editorial that was released by Gail Bolin recently and got a fair amount of attention because of the potential for cephalosporin-resistant gonorrhea. And we're really facing the emerging threat of untreatable gonococcal infection. So I just wanted to review, to set the stage, review some of the data of why we are concerned about this issue. And I'll start with some of the treatment failures that we've seen over the past decade. So one of the first reported treatment failures was a case in Japan who failed. It was a possible treatment failure to ceftonir with an elevated MIC. And then later in the decade, four possible cefixime treatment failures were reported with elevated MICs also. So sort of following a similar pattern to what we saw with the quinolone, starting in Asia. And then, as you probably remember last summer, the report about what was deemed the superbug, the pharyngeal isolate from a commercial sex worker in Japan with a markedly elevated ceftriaxone MIC. And then, alarmingly, really in the last 2 years or so, there have been multiple case reports from Europe of cefixime treatment failures, so really knocking on our door. Both from Norway and from the UK, and both heterosexuals and heterosexual men and MSM, and then another in 2011. And then most recently, Magnus Animo and colleagues described urethral isolate from a 50-year-old French gentleman that was isolated in June of 2010. And this was just published recently. He had one untraceable male contact, and he was treated initially with Cefixime 400 milligrams for urethral gonorrhea. He came back with persistent symptoms and denied interim sexual contact, and his resulting culture showed an elevated Cefixime MIC and markedly elevated ceftriaxone MIC. And we'll go over sort of what MICs mean just to situate you. He was eventually successfully treated with gentamicin, but this, in addition to the Japanese isolate, are the two that have been isolated that appear to be resistant. So in addition to treatment failures, we've also noted what we call MIC creep, increasing MICs to the cephalosporins worldwide, starting in Asia and now moving across the world. And I'll take a few minutes to situate in terms of what are MICs, what are we talking about, because they come up in almost every talk you'll hear about this topic. And they are the minimum inhibitory concentrations, which is the lowest concentration in the laboratory of antibiotic that inhibits visible growth. And the two tests that are used to generate this is either an E-test, which Mark Pandori did an excellent job describing yesterday, or agar dilution. And generally, both of these operate on the idea of growing the bacteria. So you need a live culture of the organism. It doesn't work on gnats. You need the live culture. And you grow it on a different concentrations of the antimicrobial. So you hope that that the bacteria can only grow on very low concentrations of antimicrobials, but as it may be gaining resistance, it is able to grow on higher and higher concentrations of the antimicrobial in the laboratory. Now, some of the challenges that we have, and both of these, the E-test and agar dilution, operate on this principle, though slightly differently. So some of the challenges that we face is the lack of standard interpretation of MICs for cephalosporins, and also there may be differences by laboratory and region. And also the cephalosporin MICs for resistance, the cut point to say which number is it as you go higher is resistance, has not been defined. But what has been defined is that cefixime or ceftriaxone decreased susceptibility is at an MIC of 0.5 or greater. So there's, if you can imagine sort of a line here, 0.5 and over here to higher concentrations. But also for surveillance purposes, we use a lower threshold of what we call elevated MICs of 0.25 for cefixime or 0.125 for ceftriaxone. And those are some of the thresholds that I'll discuss in some of the data I'll show. And just to, these are not resistance thresholds, but we use for surveillance purposes and are elevated beyond what you would normally expect. So in terms of some of the MIC creep that we've been seeing worldwide, these are data from Japan, and this shows the prevalence of isolates with decreased susceptibility to cefixime. And you see in 1999 and 2000, the samples they took in central Japan, none of them had elevated MICs, but this markedly increased by 2001 and increased further in 2010. And this is at a time when we were worried about fluoroquinolone resistance just emerging. And then most recently in the UK, these are data from GRASP, which is similar to GISP, it's the UK version, and it mirrors what they're seeing also throughout Europe, is they've also seen increasing MICs. This is the percentage of isolates with MICs to cefixime of 0.125 and greater. And you see an increase from blue to green to red from 08 through 10 for each of these groups, but at least these are the groups of men, but we see it particularly pronounced among men who have sex with men. And now I'll show the data from the U.S. And as many of you know, the data that we have is from the Gonococcal Isolate Surveillance Project, or GISP, that's been functioning since, we've been collecting data since 1987. It's a U.S. Sentinel surveillance system that monitors trends in gonococcal susceptibility. 29 STD clinics participate, and we collect isolates from the first 25 men per site per month. And then susceptibility is done by agar dilution. And this is the geographic representation that we have. So relative to where most of the gonorrhea is in the U.S., which is in the southeast, we relatively oversample the west, since that's where we've seen a lot of resistance emerge first with PPNG and then with QRNG, and now we're starting to see it with the cephalosporins. So this slide shows the proportion of GISP isolates with elevated MICs, so the 0.25 and greater threshold that I mentioned. And you'll note there's an absence of data from 2007 and 8, and that's because of the lack of availability of Suffixime, we didn't test during those years. But you see a relatively low proportion up until 2009. And so sometime between 2006 and 2009, the percentage started to increase, and it continues to increase through the data of January through August of 2011. And these increases have been notable by geographic lines. So the increases have been most pronounced in the West, which you see in the orange bars. There have also been increases to a smaller degree in the Midwest. And these are some data that I've stratified by site, by geographic site, just to give you some sense of the variability. And some of these you'll see, these are selected places along the West Coast and also in the Midwest. And you'll see some of them have increased and decreased, but also notably the ones I've highlighted in yellow are ones that have continued to increase. And pretty strikingly, see Honolulu, which is where we think QRNG really first emerged, we see the percentages have increased rather dramatically. And even here in Minneapolis, you see second from the bottom, you're up to about 7% of the isolates with elevated MICs to Suffixime. So many of these, particularly the isolates from the Midwest and also in the West, are from men who have sex with men. And these are the data stratified by sex of sex partner. And you see among men who have sex with men in the light blue bars, and you see that from 2006 to 2009 and 10, the percentage increased rather dramatically with still a small level among men who have sex with women. And these differences, the increases in the West and among men who have sex with men, appear not just to be of the same isolates, but there seems to be both phenomenons going on. So these are data from 2011, January through August, and you see that regardless of region, the percentage among MSM are higher than MSW, and also regardless of sex partner, the percentages are higher in the West. And we are seeing some increases to ceftriaxone, but luckily it's been really slow and gradual and still really low percentages, mercifully. But again, there's similar patterns where there's slight increases more among men who have sex with men and in the West. So for one of the other agents that we recommended for dual treatment is azithromycin. And luckily, only 2.2% of isolates in GISP in 2011 thus far show decreased susceptibility to azithromycin, or MICs of 2 or greater. However, worryingly, colleagues from Hawaii identified an isolate with high-level resistance with azithromycin, so MICs greater than 512, which is the highest we've seen in the U.S., one of the highest in the world, was identified in Hawaii last year. And also, as SO noted yesterday in his excellent presentation, there was a recent treatment failure with just the use of azithromycin by itself in Portland. So, but to keep that in context, one of the other options we have is doxycycline. And these are, and we continue to see relatively high levels of tetracycline resistance, which is a good proxy. So these are data that from GISP that go back to 1987. And you see in terms of tetracycline resistance, this green mountain range here, is that even recently we still have approximately a 20% prevalence of resistance in GISP to tetracycline. So still quite high. And if you look at just the isolates with elevated Suffixime MICs, you're looking at about a 70% prevalence of tetracycline resistance. What's also remarkable, I think, on the slide is the persistence of these resistance phenotypes in the bacterial population. So we don't really use penicillin for gonorrhea. We don't use tetracycline just for gonorrhea anymore, but yet we still see this persistence of very high level resistance because the bug holds on to the resistance that it gains. And the other reason, one of the other reasons we're very concerned is because, as many of you know, we're seeing a dwindling number of treatment options. And so the number of new systemic antimicrobial, antibacterial agents that have been approved by the FDA has declined markedly in the last 20 or 30 years. Luckily, as Dr. Krakowski noted yesterday, there are some options on the horizon, but they could be several years away. But to address the dearth of new agents, NIH and CDC are collaborating on a clinical trial to try to repurpose existing agents that are currently available. So hopefully more data will be coming out of this, but currently we're investigating two regimens for uncomplicated urogenital gonorrhea, the use of gentamicin and azithromycin together, and gemifloxacin and azithromycin together. And we're currently enrolling in 4 sites in the U.S. with a target enrollment of 500. I believe we hope to finish enrollment later this year, maybe in the late summer, early fall. So in conclusion, cephalosporin-resistant Neisseria gonorrhea is an emerging threat that many of us are very concerned about, and particularly because of the geographic and populations affected by the increasing MICs is eerily similar to those we saw with QRNG, with increases in the West initially and also among men who have sex with men. And clearly continued surveillance is critical, and new treatment options are urgently needed. But, you know, until new treatment options are available, and even now, we must now continue to plan to both detect more elegantly and to respond to these treatments. And I think some of the laboratory methods that we have available and are also looking at and looking to develop will help with this effort to both increase and enhance surveillance and also perhaps to detect resistance when it does emerge. So I'd like to thank all of these individuals, both at CDC and who've been great partners in GISP. And thank you. So we'll